Oyo and Dahomey are looked at together, and the reason for that is that from 1730, Dahomey was a tributary kingdom of Oyo. They were located in what's now the kingdom of the Republic of Benin, in the case of Dahomey, which borders on to southern Nigeria, which is where Oyo was located and was was the main empire for the Yoruba-speaking peoples of southern, what's now southern Nigeria. Oyo arose in the 17th century. The historian Robin Law, in what's one of the best general histories, probably the best general history of Oyo, his subtitle is An African Imperialism in the Era of the Slave Trade. And that very much summarises and explains how Oyo came to be a powerful kingdom in the 17th century. It was in a good position geographically. It was some way inland from the coast, but it was also connected to powerful kingdoms to the north, such as Nupe, which meant it could play a role of an intermediary. Also, its geography was helpful. It was in a savanna area, so there was the capacity for large cavalries, for example, and that, of course, gave military power to Oyo. And therefore, its rise in the 17th century was linked to those factors. Dahomey is somewhat different. Dahomey really only rose to power in the 1720s. It was in a region where there had been different kingdoms which had arisen in the 16th and 17th centuries. First, the kingdom of Alada, which was located in the southeast of what's now the Republic of Benin, not too far, in fact, from Lagos. And then Ouidah, or Ouidah, which was located around the port of Ouidah, which was one of the major slave trading ports in the history of the Atlantic slave trade. Ouidah had become more and more powerful in the late 16th century, the late 17th century. But its power had begun to decline in the 1710s and the 1720s. There had been an inflation of its cowry currency. And that, combined with the important rise of other rival kingdoms in the region, had eroded its power. So in 1724, a series of wars began, which resulted in Dahomey's capture of Ouidah from 1724 to 1727, and Dahomey's establishment as the most powerful kingdom in the region. And that continued right through until the rise of French colonialism at the end of the 19th century. However, Dahomey begins, as I said, to be tributary to Oyo. Oyo sends armies, aware of the rise of Dahomey's power. Oyo sends armies in 1730, and Dahomey becomes tributary to Oyo. Oyo's military power was very important, and particularly its cavalry. It had access to horses which came through the trans-Saharan trade. It also had a complex administrative framework which helped to structure the military power which it had. Warfare depended on the use of horses, Oyo ironsmiths, and their weapons. So the cavalrymen would have two or three spears. They'd have a thrusting spear, which was known as the oko, and a javelin, which is called the esin. And also the other important factor which was developing in the 18th century was the import of firearms, and that became an important part of Oyo's military power in the 18th century. In Dahomey, military power depended also on its relationship to firearms and the firearms trade, European trade in the 1730s, 1740s, 1750s, but also on accumulating large numbers of followers. And it was also interesting that Dahomey is an interesting example of, by the 19th century, the fact that half of its warriors were fighting in women-only platoons. And in fact, the historian Stanley Alcorn wrote this book called The Amazons of Black Sparta. So it was interesting and unusual for West Africa gendered dimension of military activities in Dahomey, which is quite a difference to Oyo. Well, in the 18th century, the rulers of Oyo were known as the Alafins. And in the 18th century, the framework of government in Oyo became more authoritarian. And what that also meant was that each time an Alafin would die, there was a more and more serious power struggle between rivals who hoped to become Alafin. What that also meant was that once somebody had become ruler or Alafin, they were only able to maintain that power through these authoritarian structures. And of course, that led to increasing resentment by subject classes and political minorities. And what that actually meant was in the 18th century, not a single Alafin would die of natural causes. So this clearly demonstrates the fact that political power and political tension had become very significant in Oyo by the 18th century. And why did that happen? Well, as I've mentioned, political power, it was a winner-takes-all situation, and that, of course, created huge tensions, and also increasing hierarchy within the kingdom, increasing resentment of the subject class, the underclass. The growth of the slave class in Oyo all meant that it was increasingly harder to resist the pushback of those forces. We could summarise that there was an increasing dependence on external trade in both Dahomey and Oyo. there was an important element, which was the role of currencies and the import of those currencies in both Dahomey and Oyo, which focused on the cowrie. And then increasing urbanisation and increasing structuring of markets in both areas. In Oyo, we could talk also of manufacturing, important craft production, especially in urban areas. Cowries were, as I said, the major currency. Most people would buy their food with cowries at markets in Oyo. Oyo cloth was also an important manufacture, and it was very well regarded in the 18th and 19th century. There are many famous weaving centres in different parts of Oyo, such as at Ijebu and Oyo Ile. So, in fact, Oyo Ile had 500 or 600 acres of indigo cultivated for dyeing. So that shows how manufacturing was an important part of the Oyo economy. And Dahomey, actually an important aspect was the way in which there was a transport infrastructure. There were good roads and bridges for facilitating trade. And the capital city, which was known as Abome, had markets on every day of the week with different items for sale, such as crafts, foods, and some luxury items like tobacco and imported cloths. And there are also rotating markets at different towns in Dahomey. For example, on Sundays it would be at Abome, on Mondays it would be at Kanamina, on Tuesdays it would be at Zobadu, and so on. And there was also a very well-organized administrative structure for managing those markets. Well, as I've mentioned, Dahomey was subordinate to Oyo in the 18th century. Oyo's imperial center was at Oyo Ile, but there were also subordinate cities, regional centers across Oyo, which paid tribute. There were actually 8 provinces in Oyo, which were known as the Ekun, and each of them was under the authority of a provincial ruler who would relate to the Alafin at Oyo Ile. And beyond that, Oyo Ile's right to rule over the cities and the provinces around was unquestioned. It was established by the precedents of the kingdom. And there was an annual tribute which was sent from the provinces to Oyo Ile, which was known as the Asingba. And that was paid by both cowries and provisions. And also troops, requisitioning of troops, which is an important part of that relationship, almost a sort of federal structure, really, essentially linking the different provinces to Oyo Ile. In Dahomey, as in Oyo, centralization of power and the establishment of the state were interconnected. Actually, many of the administrative structures were borrowed from Oyo. So one of the most important rulers or dadas of Dahomey was Tegbesu. And he had been a hostage in Oyo during the 1730s. He came to power in 1740. So that actually consolidated the administrative structures between the two kingdoms. So, for example, the borrowing of ilari or royal slaves was something which Tegbesu did, having experienced that in Oyo. And royal power was preserved really by those without access to power and social networks. And one of the things that happened in Oyo and in Dahomey was the importance of eunuchs and in royal slaves in administration, because those people didn't have access to kin networks, and that they were important features of both Oyo and Dahomey. So what you also had in Dahomey was the rapid expansion of administrative structures for dealing with international trade. For example, the official known as the Yovogan, who was at Widar and dealt with European traders. There were generals of the army and officials in the palace, all of whom helped to really enforce imperial power within Dahomey, much as it happened in Oyo. The way in which religious innovation and political power were related in Oyo can be seen through one example, who is the Alafin Abipa, who consolidated Oyo's power at the beginning of the 17th century. One of the things about Abipa is, beyond really helping to form Oyo as a major political power in the region, he was also credited with having made 2 central ritual innovations or religious innovations, the first being the Egungun cult of masquerades, which is very important in Yoruba cultures and represents the spirits of deceased ancestors, and also the divination cult of Ifa, which also remains very important to this day. So innovations did continue throughout Oyo's history, but that example from Abipa shows how fundamental it was to both political and religious power. And that remained the case in the 18th century. So, for example, Sango was a very important cult which became central to the retention of power in Oyo Ile. It also became very important in the Yoruba diaspora in the New World. But in Oyo, priests of Sango had to travel to Oyo to be initiated by priests at the shrine there. That's another good example, really, of how religious power was also fundamentally connected to political power. You can also see that very much in Dahomey. The king, or dada, who crystallised Dahomey's power in 1724 to 7 wars was known as Agadia. One of the things Agadia did when he became undisputed king of Dahomey was begin to clamp down on rival cults. So, for example, priests of the Sagbata cult who led resistance to his power, many of them were actually sold into the Atlantic slave trade. And he also centralised religious practice with the formation of new cults, the leopard cult, Agasu, which was founded in Dahomey at this time under under the Dadas and with their authority. So this all shows how religious innovation was fundamentally connected to political power and political innovation at the time, and led to really the centralization in many ways of religious practice, from what had been kind of household cults and shrines often to more centrally controlled political religious shrines, rather, in both Oyo Ile and the Tabome. Well, Oyo's decline was fundamentally connected to a whole range of different forces, which it's important to understand the differences. Firstly, as we've seen, authoritarian power had become to characterise both the maintenance of power in Oyo by the Alafins, but also the challenges to that power. And that became more and more intense towards the end of the 18th century and into the early 19th century. Class divisions became more and more important. One of the things we know is that the civil wars which led to the collapse of Oyo in the early 19th century were often led by former slaves who had escaped. And one of the things they did was change their religious orientation. Many of them converted to Islam, and that freed them from religious and political spiritual obligations. And then many of them would attack their former owners. So that shows how class divisions were an important part of the tensions which caused the unravelling of Oyo. Of course, that story also shows how the growing importance of Islam in West Africa was also a feature of this. Islam, of course, unlike other religions, African religions, did not discriminate against people necessarily in terms of caste, occupation. Once one had converted to Islam, there was no way in which you could legitimately be enslaved, for example. And this was an important, I think, facet of its attractiveness. What this had also meant was that in northern Nigeria, the early 19th century saw the rise of a reformist movement, Islam, in Sokoto, which led to the conquest of a large part of northern Nigeria by armies led by Uthman Danfodio, who became the first ruler of Sokoto. And this Islamic reform movement saw many conversions. And this began to impact southern Nigeria and Oyo. So one of the military leaders of Oyo in 1817 in Ilorin, known as Afonja, converted to Islam and led an uprising. Many of the slaves of Oyo converted to Islam, and then, as I've mentioned, used that as a way to attack their former owners. So it was a combination of many different factors. It was increasing resentment of the depredations of the slave trade, the increasing hierarchies and authoritarian nature of government which that had provoked in a kingdom like Oyo. It was the ability to convert to a religion which would not recognise discrimination according to caste and status, as Islam did. And at the same time, it was the economic shock which the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade by the British had provoked. The abolition of the transatlantic slave trade provided a very significant economic shock which affected the ability of the Alafins of Oyo to maintain the power structures which they'd initially had. That happened in 1807. The rebellion by Afonja happened in 1817, and Oyo began to really unravel in the 1820s. So all these frameworks and facets were very much connected. Dahomey, however, was further from northern Nigeria. It was therefore slightly more insulated from some of those forces which led to the collapse of Oyo. I think the other thing which is important in Dahomey, it was a newer kingdom, whereas Oyo went back to the early 17th century. As we've seen, Dahomey only rose in the 1720s. So there hadn't been as long a period of time for the development of the class tensions and difficulties which had happened in Oyo. So Dahomey didn't actually collapse until the rise of French colonialism in the late 19th century. Its rulers, its dadas, were able to adapt to production of what was known as legitimate trade crops, or crops such as groundnuts, palm oil particularly in Dahomey, which were important for the growing manufacturing industries in Europe. So Dahomey actually remained in power as a powerful kingdom in what's now Benin until the late 19th century. Oyo and Dahomey both have a powerful legacy in that part of West Africa. Oyo as the centre of Yoruba culture for two centuries. The Yoruba speakers as one of the most important, as some of the most important peoples living in Nigeria today. And the aftermath also of the collapse of Oyo was very significant. Many of the refugees who left Oyo founded the large settlement, Yoruba-speaking settlement, at Abeokuta. Very many important figures in Nigerian history came from Abeokuta, such as the Nobel Prize-winning writer Wole Soyinka. So Oyo's legacy was very powerful and remains very powerful in Nigeria to this day. And also, it should be said, in the diaspora. So one of the impacts of the collapse of Oyo was the large preponderance of Yoruba speakers who went as captives to the Americas in the late 18th, particularly in the early 19th century, particularly actually to northeastern Brazil, and created a very strong nexus of Yoruba culture in northeastern Brazil which survives to this day, for example, in the practice of Candomblé, which is the Yoruba-inspired religion, which is very significant to this day in northeastern Brazil. So it had a very many different types of legacy, both in Nigeria, but actually also beyond. And not only northeastern Brazil, it should also be said in Cuba, the religion of Santeria is also very heavily influenced by Yoruba peoples because of the large migration at this time. Dahomey's influence, I think, also very powerful in Benin, partly, of course, because it lasted much longer to the end of the 19th century. The structures of power and governance which it produced were therefore more enduring. Also symbolically, Ouida remains one of the most powerful symbols and important places in the history of the transatlantic slave trade. It was the port from which more Africans left the continent than any other port on the continent. And it retains that symbolic power to this day, both in terms of peoples from the New World who come to Africa to try and understand that awful process in history, and also more powerfully, more symbolically, I should say, across the world in terms of the memory of that history. So there are many ways in which both kingdoms retain that power to this day.